Call the meeting to order for Thursday, March 5th. I should know that. My son's birthday was Tuesday. So anyway, to order for the State Government Finance Division. Representative Quam, did you get a chance to look at the minutes? If not, Representative Hewitt, did you get a chance to look at the minutes? You were.
Mr. Chair, I have the minutes for
March 4th.
March 4th. I so move.
Representative Hewitt moves the approval of the minutes for March 4th, 2020. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. The first bill on today is House File 3499, and we're going to switch chairs here because I have to present the bill. And I'll move House File 3499 to be before us. I see there's an amendment that was put in. And so if the amendment goes on, we'll have to decide where we got to send it then. So I move House File 3499.
All right. Please, Representative Nelson, present your bill, please.
House File 3499 is the HAVA bill, the Help America Vote Act. This is kind of deja vu all over again because we did this last year. It was a different set of money we got from the federal government. This is a new set of money that they passed in December to give us. And last year we had $6.5 million that we passed 2 years after we were given the money from the federal government. This money here gets $7.39 or almost $7.4 million that we're getting this year. The bill, as it's directed here, does not have the match in it. That's the one difference. Last year's bill was a 5% match. This is a 20% match that we have to come up with, although we have 2 years to come up with that match. To get this money out and get it to the Secretary of State's office, that's why we did not include the match in the original bills, because we don't know whether we're going to have a target, if there's going to be a omnibus bill or going to be separate bills going forward. That hasn't been decided yet. We just got the forecast last week, and there'll be a couple more weeks till we get our targets. So that's why the bill was written the way it was, without the target and without the matching dollars in it. And again, it just basically is to give the Secretary of State money. It's listed in the bill, the modernizing, securing, updating statewide voter registration system, improving accessibility, training materials, implementing improvements of the election system, which is what last year we gave a portion of it went to local governments to upgrade their election equipment. And it's the same things. These are laid out in federal law, these things that the Secretary can spend it on. And with that, I'll turn it over to the Secretary of State, who's here, and he can explain what his intentions are with the money this year.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Secretary of State Simon, if you would state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Member. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thanks for your time and attention. We're here again because of Statute 5.30, which requires legislative approval for this federally appropriated money. This stems from the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, which was passed in 2002. So when first this statute was used, it was in 2003. Representative Nelson, I think, is the only person here who was there in 2003 in that session. And in the same bill that enacted this state statute, 5.30, the legislature also gave to then Secretary Mary Kiffmeyer the use of almost the exact same amount, $6.5 million in federal funds. So there was no delay. The same bill that created this process that we're in right now also gave the money to the Secretary of State's office. I can't say the same thing about 2018 and 2019. As you all know, the money was held up. Minnesota was the last state in the country to get the money, mm-hmm. The very last state. And I want to say it's certainly not a partisan issue. Far from it. The vote off the House floor here was 126 votes, so virtually unanimously. And I have to call out in particular Representative Vogel, obviously Chair Nelson, Representative O'Driscoll, Representative Albright, Representative Nash, people who regardless of political party, we're really supportive and understood that this is an everybody issue. It's not a partisan issue. There's longstanding precedent for getting this money for the purpose for which Congress intended it. So just to zoom out again, and you've heard me say it a number of times, but I do want to make a clean record here, which is that in 2016, Minnesota was one of the 21 states whose election system was targeted by a foreign government. That is consensus. That is the unanimous opinion of all 17 U.S. intelligence organizations, repeated loudly and recently. And so we know that that's something we ought to be looking forward to in 2020. Not that it will happen, but what the intelligence officials tell us is that our adversaries have both the appetite and the capability to do it again. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they will, but they have the want to and they have the can to do it again. And we have to be vigilant about that. And so experts in the intelligence community in Congress and in the Office of President have acknowledged that the issue is not going away. And we have to anticipate even more, perhaps, in this presidential election year. As Chair Nelson just said, the difference between last time and this time, last time it was about $6.5 million and the state match was 5%. Mm-hmm. This time Congress and the President have given us more money, $7.4 million, but have asked for more skin in the game, a 20% match. And I don't know of any other secretary in the state in the country that has complained about that. That seems mm-hmm. really reasonable, actually, that they should ask for a little bit more money this time. So that's more of a burden, of course, on state legislatures, but that seems like a fair trade. So we're seeking authorization again for these funds. I just want to say there are federal safeguards built into this. We are audited, as are all states, by an organization called the EAC, the Election mm-hmm. Assistance Commission, on the federal level. And the auditing is so tight, as a matter of fact, and the requirements so strict, that when our folks are working on certain projects, like the four-year project to rebuild and recode the statewide voter registration system, mm-hmm. we have to keep track of our time in 15-minute increments. Mm-hmm. And we have to report that. You can't just say, worked on this today. You have to say, worked on this for 5 hours and 45 minutes or 6 hours and 15 minutes or whatever the case may be. And we will be audited on a regular basis, as will all states. And Minnesota has never been dinged, has never had a bad finding in recent years as to the use of this money. So that's good. And we can only spend the money within the narrow categories that are reflected in the actual bill. So we can't color outside the lines. We can't do anything that the EAC doesn't approve, or else they will claw back that money. I want to say a word about the rules here with respect to the match. I understand there's an amendment offered by or intended to be offered by Representative Nash that would also add the match money here. The rule, according to the Help America Vote Act, is pretty clear. We have 2 years to get the match, so we have 2 years from last December, so December of 2021, to receive it. And we need not get the match before we start spending the underlying money. Obviously, you don't want to get too far out ahead, because if you don't get the match within 2 years, the federal government will claw back the money. Mm-hmm. That seems reasonable, actually, to me. And so the only thing I would say about the amendment, I think it's great. I appreciate the spirit in which it's intended. I would only say this, and I leave that to all of you. I don't have a say or a voice in that particular process, but if there isn't a supplemental budget, I wouldn't want this bill to be held up. So I would hope that if the amendment is added, and I appreciate the amendment, we want the match money, obviously, because we need this money this year. I wouldn't want the underlying money to be held up because there isn't a supplemental budget at all this year, and that's mm-hmm. subject to the whims of budget politics, and you all are involved in that. So I would only request that at some point later, if the amendment is put on, that it can be taken off so that the rest of the mm-hmm. bill can move. That would be my only request. I want to talk a little bit about how the money will be spent. Many of you were personally involved in the working group that our office put together in 2018 and 2019 to answer just that question. What will we do with these resources? So we had a large group, both caucuses, both chambers, IT experts, representatives from counties, cities, and townships, who, of course, do the frontline electioneering work of counting ballots and tabulating votes and so forth. And we came up with a plan, and that plan is scalable. So it's doing more of the things that we already talked about. And let me just give a couple examples. I won't drown you with details, except a couple that I think are compelling examples. You may know that our office, let me back up. One advantage, maybe the only one, of being 50th in the country in getting this money is we have the benefit of other states' experience. So we can call other states and say, how did you use your money? What worked and what really didn't work? And unanimously, what states tell us worked is hiring so-called cyber navigators. So we have done that. We hired one. And that's a fancy title for someone who is housed in our office who helps with our partners, our teammates in the cities, counties, and townships. They're the ones who count the votes. We don't count a single vote in our office. He's been making the rounds across the state. I don't know if he's reached all 87 yet, but he is also the go-between between the U.S. intelligence community in Washington and the local units of government, so he can help translate some of the information that they get as well. It's particularly important because only 9 out of our 87 counties have full-time, year-round elections-only people, as many of you know, because they're your counties. In most counties in the state, the norm is the person who does elections also might do property taxes, also might do inspections, also might do ditch and drainage work, also might even do public housing. They have various responsibilities. They wear a lot of hats. It doesn't mean that their commitment is any less to election security. It's just they're stretched really thin, and so the resources are really appreciated. All that is to say that other states have been able to commit a lot more resources to a cyber navigator program. Illinois has 8 of them, for example. They're a bigger state, no question, but on a pro rata basis, we would have 2 or 3 at least. Mm-hmm. And so beefing up that program is one example. The other, as Chair Nelson alluded to, is, you know, last time around, we earmarked about $1 million to local sub-grants to help our partners at local governments buy the things they need in order to ensure election security. We want a lot more than that out of this money. We want a large portion of it to be dedicated to local subgrants, because we know what it's like in our office for another unit of government to come in, to swoop in, look at your stuff, recommend things that cost a lot of money. That's what happens when the intelligence community does regular testing and, you know, penetration testing and other things in our office. The good news there is they've provided this money. We want to do the same for local governments. We don't just want our cyber navigator to swoop in, make a bunch of costly recommendations, and leave. We want to be able to have some money that they can use to at least offset the cost of those recommendations. So I want to thank you for your time and attention and all your past support. It's been close to unanimous, if not unanimous, in this committee and even off of the House floor. Really appreciate it. It's a priority, and it's an issue that's not going away. If anything, we've been told by the intelligence community to be extra vigilant this year, given the obvious stakes and circumstances. So thanks, members, for your consideration.
Thank you, Secretary of State Simon. We do have the A1 amendment. Is there any, would someone like to offer that amendment?
Madam Chair, I would.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I would offer the A1, and I'd like to provide some context.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary Simon, good to see you again. It's getting to be kind of a regular appearance. I don't know if we just put you on the regular docket and just, you know, have our morning coffee together.
Yeah.
Here's why I think this is important, and you spoke to some of these points as well, and so we're in concurrence with that. But the federal match is one of those things that is being requested, and I think just like we have in the last HABA round, if you will, say what you want, but I think let's streamline and clean that up so that we don't nix it like some might suggest we did last year. One of the objections that we heard from the Senate from last session is that we didn't provide for that match, and so let's make sure that we provide that up front. The federal government is looking for it. It comes out of the general fund. I think you've said in testimony in this committee and others that you would appreciate receiving it earlier rather than later. And in talking with the chair of Ways and Means, it's something certainly that I think he would accommodate. But if not, he can certainly take it out in his committee. I don't think that there's any disparaging nature to this.
Yeah.
I think, if anything, this shows the intent of this committee towards wanting to make sure that the integrity and the robust nature of our elections is intact. And so as a sign and as a testimony to making sure that Minnesota stays at the forefront of election integrity, I would offer the amendment. It does come out of the general fund, and with that, members, I would hope that you could support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Chair Nelson, would you like to speak to the amendment?
Yes, I would. Members, one thing, though, that last year the bill, the HABA bill, the House File 14, did have the match in it. It wasn't the full match because a lot of the money that the Secretary's office had already spent was able to be credited towards that match. The reason, like I said in my testimony earlier, that the reason we didn't put the match in this bill is we don't know what our target is going to be. This would come out of our target, whether it's general fund money or any other money. That being said, the match is a one-time spending, and as if we, when we looked at the budget forecast, there's a lot of that money that was in the so-called surplus was one-time spending money. It was not money that should be spent on ongoing programs. This would fit into that, and so I would like to not have the amendment go on, but I understand I wouldn't be opposed to the amendment going on. If the amendment goes on, we're going to have to hold it in the committee till we get our budget targets. Otherwise, we could send this forward, possibly right to the floor right now to speed the process along. And then if we get a budget target, we could put that in a bill that we've put out of the committee to fund that match. So that's be my preference that it didn't go on, but I wouldn't be opposed to it going on.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Members, are there any questions or discussions about the amendment? On the amendment, Representative Quam?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the concern that the Secretary of State brought up about there possibly not being a supplemental budget with a couple billion sitting in the rainy day fund, billion and a half projected, and listening to any of the leadership in either chamber speaking about things that they're wishing to spend that on, I think it'd be pretty slim that there was not a supplemental budget. So I would think your concerns should be alleviated.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Long, did you?
Not on the amendment.
Thank you very much. Chair Nelson, would you like to add any additional comments?
Like I said, I wouldn't oppose the match going on, but like I said, that would mean we'll have to hold it in committee and we won't get the bill out to the floor. If we put forward without the match, it would go forward to the floor and we could get this process moved along a little bit quicker. But it's not going to break my heart if the amendment goes on.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
To that point, I have great respect for Representative Nelson. I just do want to take exception with the notation that we would have to hold it in committee. It certainly could pass out of this and move towards Ways and Means as we wait for budget targets. We have in this committee and others over the course of the last couple of weeks passed bills off of the committee floors onto the Ways and Means or onto the floor that are waiting for budget targets as well. So I would take exception with that, I think that, you know, we need to expedite this through the House. We're still going to have to wait for the Senate to concur or to get their act together. So I think if we do our job well, that just certainly sends a signal to the Senate that we mean business and hopefully they will comply.
Thank you, Representative Albright. With that, members, we will be taking a vote. I will be voting yes for this amendment to go on. With that, we'll take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Such bonus. Members, are there any questions to the bill? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Excuse me, Quam.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. You're next on the list, Representative Quam. Representative Quam.
We are both wearing, you know, reddish ties, so. I have a query for the Secretary of State because on line 1.13, improving accessibility. So that means some of these funds would be able to help prevent a website crash, you know, for that, so we didn't have that difficulty. And also, do we have any better understanding? Was it just bad software, hardware, or was there a intrusion attack that caused the crash?
Mm-hmm. Secretary of State Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. So yes, I'll give you an update since I last testified on this. We again have no evidence to suggest that there was any outside intrusion that had to do with the service interruption. And since yesterday, I've learned that we've been working with the Department of Homeland Security, we've been working with Minute, we've looked at the traffic, we've looked at the logs, and there's no reason yet for any evidence yet to suggest that it was the result of any outside interference. It was likely a problem with SVRS, the very system that we're using this money to update and recode. So that's the latest update. I'll keep you updated, but thanks for the question. That is new since yesterday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary Simon, the Congress doesn't always like to spend money, and the fact that they keep giving us significant amounts of money for this, I think, is meaningful. I'm curious, why do you think Congress is so committed to giving states access to these funds?
Madam Chair and Representative Long, I think it's that the evidence is staring them in the face. And I want to give credit where it's due here, not only to Congress, but to the President. He signed this as well. And I think they see the evidence, they get the intelligence report, they get the threat assessments, and they know that our adversaries are not playing around. That's the best I can tell you.
Representative Long.
Madam Chair.
Oh, excuse me, Chair Nelson.
And as we go back to 2003, when that money was first passed back then, and the HAVA money, the Congress basically said, we're not going to give you any more money going forward. You're going to have to figure out how to do this on your own. And it was a surprise 2 years ago when they passed the HAVA money that we authorized last year. And this is another surprise that they're giving this money. Again, it shows how committed Congress is to making sure that our election systems are safe and secure, and that our citizens of our states and of the country can have confidence that our elections are not tampered with. So that's important. And again, the Congress and the President can be lauded for that.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I certainly supported our efforts previously to make this an automatic spend rather than having to go through this process. But since we're here, it seems like every time the Senate is trying to put conditions on our ability to spend this money, and the most recent one seems to be provisional balloting. The concern of Congress seems to be that we need to protect our elections from foreign interference. Does provisional balloting have any relation to that?
Secretary of State Simon.
Madam Chair and Representative Long, no, it doesn't. And I just want to say generally, and I want to thank all the members here and in the House generally for really over the last couple of years showing real leadership and self-restraint and not coupling this with other things or holding it up as a bargaining chip. Look, reasonable minds can disagree in this room and elsewhere about any election policy, including provisional balloting. Some think it's great. Some, like me, think it's not. But we're not going to use election security as trade bait. We're just not. And so if someone's for it, that's great. If they're not, that's great too. But we're not going to trade the security of our election system for someone's idea of other unrelated good election policy. We're just not going to do that. And it's not responsible to suggest it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Secretary of State. Members, are there any more questions? Anyone from the audience wanting to testify for or against the bill? Thank you. Seeing none, Chair Nelson, I would ask, given the amendment that has been attached, do you want to read? Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'm going to modify my motion that House File 3499, as amended, be held over for possible further consideration, and when we get our targets, I'm moving it out probably at that time.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. And with that, the bill will be held over.
Thank you, members.
The next bill on our agenda is House File 2230, Representative Mason.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 2230 to the General Register.
Representative Mason, I think our intention here is to hold this over because of the next bill over kind of a mesh with each other and maybe a little bit competing. So we're going to, the intent is to hold this over for further consideration. Yeah, I was going
to. Okay, thank you. This bill is basically does some technical changes and an update, and I will let Mr. Hurst give you the details.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Salon and Spas Professional Association, a trade association based here in Minnesota that has been in existence since 1924. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on House File 2230. I wish to thank our author, Representative Mason. And as she mentioned in her opening remarks, this is truly a housekeeping measure that primarily pertains to continuing education as it pertains to the cosmetology industry. Continuing education has been very well received since its inception about close to 10 years ago. And roughly what is required with continuing education, it's a condition of renewal of one's license. So within every 3 years, the licensee must obtain 4 hours of education pertaining to health, safety, and sanitation practices, along with state and rule with cosmetology, as well as an additional 4 hours focused on professional practice with implements, tools, devices, and the like. So what 2230 purports to do has no negative impact on licensees as far as their existing 8-hour requirements. Rather, what it does is it expands on who may be a provider of continuing education in Minnesota. And by that, we are suggesting that it be offered by franchised salon operators in the state of Minnesota. Currently, professional associations may provide continuing education. Salons themselves may, as well as schools of cosmetology and higher institutions of learning as well. So what this does is to provide franchisers such as Great Clips, which is a home-based domiciled franchiser with many locations in the state, to provide the 4 hours of professional practice education, which is in conjunction with that organization's ongoing education that they provide to their franchise employees. So it's a very nice way to mesh what they offer at the same time to their employees. Furthermore, there's some cleanup within the requirements for all providers. We recognize that when we viewed the existing statute, that there is no provision for when an existing provider chooses to no longer continue being a provider. And there are requirements for a provider to maintain and retain records for up to 5 years. And so what this bill also does is provide a method by which if an existing provider chooses to no longer provide, they can transfer their records to an already existing provider as a caretaker of those records. Lastly, one other thing within the continuing education requirements for the health, safety, and sanitation requirements, we are asking that some time be devoted within the existing time to make available information to attendees regarding domestic abuse awareness. And we're not suggesting any specific curriculum, just to make some information available so that attendees, if they so choose, know where to go and find information if it's deemed appropriate for them in their interactions with their clients. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, I wish to request from a member for a verbal amendment to the bill. And that is simply there is no effective date with this. Continuing education by providers is based on a calendar year. We are in the middle of a calendar year, and so I would humbly seek a verbal amendment to make the bill with an effective date of January 1 of 2021 so that it goes forward in conjunction with the next calendar year for the providers and for the board. And in closing, this legislation was shared with the State Board of Cosmetology to make sure they were okay with it, and they have indicated that they have no problems with the legislation. With that, I will wrap up my comments and certainly welcome any questions that that the committee may have.
And members, we're going to hold off doing the effective date. Council here has said they'd have to add a new section, and it'd be easier to do that when we take it back up later on. Otherwise, a bill without an effective date, August 1st, right, is the automatic default that we have. But we will keep that in mind and have that worked up, have the amendment worked up when we take this back up. Questions? Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier or to Representative Mason, my whole world is about continuing education, so this is kind of a sensitive area to me. Real quick question. So is what you're doing with the bill, would this limit, like, outstate experts to come in and throw a conference for salon owners?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hewitt, no, not at all. The existing process for continuing education does not limit outside experts from participating with a provider's presentation of continuing education, and that does not change with this bill before us today.
Mr. Representative Hewitt.
So, Mr. Chair, if I'm hearing you right, then they could hold a national conference here. The individuals in Minnesota can get CEUs for that conference. Is that right?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hewitt, that is correct, provided it is provided the provider has been recognized by the board, and there's a process for providers of continuing education to be recognized and be approved for their curriculum and everything. So that would be part of the entire submission with the state board. And I've never heard of any problem with the state board not accepting that. And certainly during the course of the year, if it's a new item that is added to the continuing education offering, the provider is certainly eligible to make that notice to the state board. But in general, it's never been a problem.
Representative Hewitt.
And one last question, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. So with this, can salon owners use this as part of a benefit package to offer CEUs to their client, to their personnel for free, or is there a charge expected to be submitted with this back to the state for fees, or explain that a little.
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, salons may only offer the 4 hours of professional practice requirements for continuing education. It's up to the salon themselves how they wish to offer that. If it's internal to their own salon employees, it's up to them if it's a benefit. But certainly salons are certainly allowed to make their offerings open to all licensees, regardless of whether they are an employee of theirs or not. And so in that regards, you know, they may charge for their offerings. And I think currently, I think most continuing education offerings run anywhere between $30 and $60, I think. So there's a range there, and certainly there's also a web-based option that can be pursued also with some of these providers as well.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that gives me a better understanding. I appreciate your time.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Didn't mean to shock you.
What's that?
I didn't mean to shock you.
That's okay. No, it's good. I got my coffee, but just curious to the testifier. Under 4, where it says that a franchisor can now put on CE, would a non-employee or a non-member of that franchise be able to take those classes as well, or is this going to be just an exclusive thing for their franchise people?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Vogel, no, the bill specifically targets it for just their franchisee employees and no one outside of that. And certainly Great Clips, who I mentioned, was involved with chatting with us in creating this provision, and they certainly wanted it that way. And And overall, there would be concern by some existing salons who have employees. They wouldn't want to see the potential for, you know, a larger salon such as Great Clips to potentially take away their employees as a opportunity in a continuing education class. But certainly Great Clips certainly wanted this to be focused on their franchisee employees, and they had no intention or interest in expanding it beyond people who were not one of their franchisee employees.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I'm thinking of the home base practitioners that are always probably seeking out CE opportunities, and I can understand the desire to do this, but I also, I've had an insurance license, and I know sometimes how difficult it is when you're not affiliated with a larger organization, when you're just a mom and pop, to find opportunities for this. So that was the reason for the question is, and maybe it's impossible to do, but I think opening this up to as many people and as many practitioners of the CE as possible is nice from the standpoint of especially the smaller operators.
Mr. Chair, if I could make comment in regards to that, Representative Vogel, I would agree with you if there was a problem with not having enough providers in existence in the state. Currently, I believe there are somewhere between 30 and 40 providers of continuing education for cosmetologists, and it has never come to our attention across the state that there's a problem in obtaining a provider, either in person or online.
Mr. Harrison, I was thinking the question when you were saying that. Outstate, if they can do these online, so outstate, it's helpful with that. There is not limitations that they're all in the metro area. Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Representative Vogel. Any further questions? If not, we'll lay this over for possible or for further consideration. And then at that time, we'll take up the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The next bill we have is Representative Christensen's House File 3202. And members, I'll move the bill. And again, members, we're going to hold this one over also for further consideration. There's a fiscal note being generated for that, and we don't have that yet, so that's why we're holding it over. I understand there's an amendment that did meet our deadlines, and when we take this up in the future, we'll put that amendment on, but our page will pass out the amendment for us. So Representative Christensen, proceed with your presentation.
Okay, I'm sorry. Is the amendment going around right now? Oh, okay, thank you. I thought I was supposed to be doing that. Thanks so much.
Do you have a copy? Representative Christensen, do you have a copy of the amendment?
I do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. That's
thank you.
So, Representative, explain your bill and then explain what the amendment does, and then we can go to your other testifiers.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's start with the DE amendment. Now let's start with my bill, because that will put context in this. Basically, my bill is going to be addressing the hairstyling and wedding venue makeup industry. And the DE amendment is going to be, I'm going to have this lady explain it for me, okay? Megan Forbes, yeah.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Megan Forbes. I'm an attorney at the Institute for Justice. The DE amendment adds a four-hour sanitation training through board-approved continuing education providers that artists must complete in order to qualify for the exemption for hairstyling and makeup services as it's defined in the bill.
Representative Christensen.
Okay. Do you want more explanation for that, or should I go on with the bill?
go on with the bill. That's,
okay.
I don't see anybody that had their hand up that doesn't understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill, as amended, exempts simple hairstyling, which is washing, drying, arranging, and styling, hair and makeup artistry from cosmetology licensing upon completion of 4 hours of infection control and sanitation training. The bill addresses a problem that many special event hair and makeup artists face in Minnesota because of the way the cosmetology board interprets its rules exempting certain beauty services from cosmetology licensing. There are hundreds of special event hair and makeup artists in Minnesota. Many artists have spent years building successful businesses, and most of these businesses are women-owned. Artists provide bridal hair and makeup services to brides and wedding parties at wedding venues. There are no storefronts. They also provide hair and makeup services for commercials, film, theater, and other commercial productions. Bridal hair and makeup is usually their most profitable service. By rule, the Minnesota Cosmetology Board exempts beauty services for fashion, film, photography, and at retail makeup counters. Special event hair and makeup artists who work in these areas do not need a cosmetology license or a salon manager's license or a special event permit. For years, bridal hair and makeup artists believed they were legally providing their services under the Cosmetology Board's exemption for beauty services for photography. After all, wedding day is the most photographed day in most people's lives. But the board has made clear that bridal hair and makeup artists are not exempt and are required to comply with licensing requirements and to obtain a special event permit. These licensing requirements are burdensome, to say the least. Minnesota requires two licenses and a special event permit for them to work. To comply with these requirements, many artists would have to stop working, close their businesses, and spend between $10,000 to $20,000 receiving cosmetology training. Minnesota requires 1,500 hours of cosmetology training for simple hairstyling and makeup, or $600 for only makeup. 600 hours, I'm sorry, for only makeup. Minnesota also requires artists to pass 4 exams and to become a salon manager. Until this month, the board additionally required artists to spend $2,700 working in a cosmetology salon, which usually took on an additional 2 to 3 years for artists to complete. Finally, the state requires artists to obtain a special event permit and to register for every wedding or event that they work at least 48 hours before the event. The cosmetology curriculum is geared toward providing haircuts, color, using chemicals, doing facials, waxing, and nails. Very little time is spent in that training on services that special event hair and makeup artists do. Right now, the constitutionality of the board's different treatment of artists who provide their services for weddings is also being challenged by a group of bridal hair and makeup artists in court. They're additionally challenging the board's application of the cosmetology licensing requirements to bridal hair and makeup artists. The bill will level the playing field for all artists in Minnesota who provide simple hairstyling and makeup. It exempts these services because artists are already providing, safely providing these services in the state without any oversight or regulation. I ask for your support to help protect these entrepreneurs and small businesses who make an important contribution to our state. I'd like to add that I believe probably in all of your districts, and I know I live in the Stillwater-St. Croix Valley area, and we are a very, very popular wedding venue, especially in Stillwater. And so this affects a lot of my constituents. I have a lot of these business professionals in my district, and I have a feeling that you have some in yours too. So, you know, I ask that you support House File 3202, and I'm open for questions. Well, actually, we have some testifiers. I'm sorry, we have some testifiers. Do we want to do questions first, Mr. Chair?
Is there anybody that have any questions right now? Otherwise, if we'll go to testimony. Seeing nobody's hand jumping up, why don't we go with testimony? I've got a list here of some We'll start with those. Christina Zimmer, or Zimmer?
Zimmer.
Zimmer, okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Christina Zimmer. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 3202. I am Christina Zimmer. I am the owner of Christina Zimmer Beauty. I have been a small business owner for the last 4 years and have been doing makeup and hairstyling for the last 12 years. I would like to share how the current laws affect my business and life, along with the lives of over a thousand other artists. I've always known that makeup artistry and a career in beauty was what I wanted to do, and I've never seen myself having a different career path. When someone introduced me to the world of freelance and special event makeup, I instantly fell in love, and I never looked back. I honed my craft over the last 12 years as a special event makeup artist and hairstylist, and now bridal and special events are 80% of my business. I specialize in special event wedding hair and makeup. I don't cut or color. I don't chemically alter hair. I don't perform facials. I don't wax. I don't apply chemicals to the skin. Bridal hair and makeup is my bread and butter. The majority of my clients who book through me are through word of mouth and referrals from other brands. I work hard to hold myself to the highest safety standards. I sanitize my kit, my products. I use different brushes on every client. I wash my hands in between my services. I come prepared for every job. I have 60-plus five-star reviews, and my reputation is something I'm incredibly proud of. I have brides who booked me 2 years out from their wedding date, and I've done this unlicensed along with hundreds of others. The Cosmetology Board has decided that in order for special event hairstylists and makeup artists like myself to continue working, we will need to go to cosmetology school to complete thousands of hours of training. We've always thought we were exempt from the cosmetology licensing requirements because we provide services for photography. But the board wants us to become licensed cosmetologists or estheticians. I've done countless photo shoots for brides, for fake brides using models that have been featured in blogs and magazines, which is completely legal for me to do. But somehow, applying makeup to a bride on her wedding day in the same setting, at the same location, suddenly makes me a criminal. These real brides have been featured along the fake ones in the same magazine publications. How is one of these services different from the other? Why does one require no training and the other requires thousands of hours worth of training that don't apply to what I do, along with several fees? We also need to get a special event permit, which requires us to first become salon managers, pass the salon managers test, and then register every single event, like Representative Christensen stated, 48 hours prior to the event. I have worked day and night for the last 4 years to build my business into what it is today, and I'm not the only one who has. This room is filled with talented, capable, intelligent business owners.
I hear you have a support.
This is how we put food on the table for our families. This is how we pay our mortgages. This is how we pay for our children's piano lessons and soccer camps. These overreaching laws affect primarily women and minority-owned businesses, along with a few men as well. Starting over would cause insurmountable financial strain on my family and so many others. It's not something I or we can afford to do. I'm risking everything to stand before you all today and give my testimony. I'm risking my career, my business, and how I financially provide for my family. If the law is not changed, I will have to shut down my business, and so will thousands of other women across the state. This is urgent for us, and this needs to be addressed now for our livelihoods, our families, and the very thing we love to do. My career as a makeup artist is a part of who I am, and if I couldn't continue to do my job and provide these services to my clients, I feel as though a piece of me would be missing. I love what I do, and I'm so fortunate that I get to say that. My hope is my testimony will save my business and the business of countless other people. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my story, and I ask you to support House File 3202.
Ms. Zimer, you said that you started your business 12 years ago. What year did you start your business?
I started my business 4 years ago. I've been in the beauty industry for 12. I've worked at retail cosmetics, other things like that.
I thought you said you started your business 12 years ago because the exemptions that were put in for photography was in 2009. If you had done it 12 years ago, you would have started before those exemptions were put in.
Correct.
Oh, that's the question. Representative Kwong.
My questions come after the testifiers.
Okay. Representative Green, this testifier or after all of them?
I will ask this testifier, and I think it probably will pertain to all of them. The added fees that you're going to have, not to mention the time lost, the added fees that you're going to incur, do you have any idea what they are?
Ms. Zimer.
Representative Green, are you talking about the fees if I were to be fined or the fees if I were to pay them to go back to school and all of those extra fees that come along with that? Because those are different numbers.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I'm talking about the fees you'd pay for every single time you have to go get another permit to do another wedding. Every permit you're going to have to pay for whatever you have to do, and what is it going to cost you for continuing education. Do you know what it's going to cost your business is what I'm asking you.
Ms. Zimer.
To go back to school, it's $20,000. To get your manager's license, I'm not sure off the top of my head what that fee is, but I think it's a few hundred dollars. And then the special events permit is $75. And then to register every event with the Board of Cosmetology 48 hours prior to the event. And then there's continuing education fees on top of that, yes. And those, I think, are every 3 years for cosmetologists. And I don't know that fee off the top of my head right now, but I mean, that's plenty of hours lost that I could be building revenue for my business and, you know, working with brides. So that's time lost and money lost for me. So each wedding for me is, you know, starts at $600. So if I'm losing time spending with my clients, that really adds up fast.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, to the rest of folks in the audience and to the people on this committee, you know, this is what small businesses deal with all across the state of Minnesota. So I hate to tell you this, but welcome to the overregulated world of Minnesota, because this is what we do to our small businesses all across the state, and it's a crying shame. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Representative Green.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, this testifier. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Zimer. Our 12-year-old granddaughter is in the dance big time, so at Christmas she's getting all of this makeup stuff. And then they put it on each other, of course, because they're going to dance, right? My question is, the stuff that you're going to be applying, or whatever we call it, mm-hmm. is that any different than the things that she couldn't have gotten for Christmas just off the shelf and they put on themselves?
Ms. Zimer.
Representative Vogel. So mainly makeup products that women are using on a daily basis are things that you can buy at the store. I would say a lot of my products are things that women can buy at Sephora and Ulta and, you know, a little bit at Walgreens as well. I use it, you know, expensive products in my kit. But, yes, these are things that the public can buy and use on a daily basis.
Representative Logan.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was, I guess, when we're looking at the necessity for licensing, I'm thinking of those kids that go and buy, could basically buy the same stuff, put it on each other without any expertise such as this. So it makes me believe that they're certainly on the right track of doing this, at least professionally, with the education and the experience they have, because 12-year-olds are doing it to themselves.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Zimer. The next person I have on the list is Amy Reed. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Amy Reed, and I am the owner of Amy Marie Artistry. I'm a registered business in the state of Minnesota. I'm a freelance makeup artist, and I'm blessed that this career supports myself and my three children. They say, do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. That's me. Makeup was an unregulated service years ago when I attended Faces, Etc. of Minnesota Professional Makeup School. I received an entire education dedicated to makeup. At the time, I had spoken with different cosmetology schools inquiring about makeup training. I received the same response that makeup was only a day or two out of the entire $20,000 program. I knew it didn't make sense for me to learn to cut and color hair, wax, or do nails and pedicures, as I never wanted to work in a salon. The consumer demand for bridal hair and makeup has kept me and thousands of others busy. While on-site bridal services have boomed, the BCE wants to stake their claim by finding and shutting down businesses like mine. They made an example of other successful artists to scare us into cosmetology and aesthetics programs. This was done by reinterpreting their own rules to capitalize on our success and cherry-picking the bridal industry as their jurisdiction. Makeup artists have been serving brides in Minnesota for over 40 years without any regulation. This is greed on their part, as they're not interested in any of the other makeup facets I work in. I work for many Minnesota companies such as Polaris, Medtronic, iTalk 107, and several other production and photography companies. I prepare CEOs for corporate internal videos, take care of talent for product videos and commercials, work on feature films, senior pictures, runway shows, plus many other things. Outside of Minnesota, I've worked for Ford, Honda, and the Super Bowl. I most recently was contracted by NBC to prep Joe Biden's hair and makeup for a live TV broadcast. The BCE does not require a license for any of these other services. They're all unregulated. I ask, why can I do the hair and makeup for the former vice president of the United States of America, but I am not able to put lipstick on a bride in the state of Minnesota? The BCE isn't interested in any of my other clients outside of bridal. They're not interested in the Clinique counter at Nordstrom's or the Mary Kay lady outselling her product. They want a stake in the $70 billion wedding industry by putting their restrictive regulations on hardworking people like me. I built an extensive resume, and I did that because of me. My reputation in business is successful without a piece of paper that costs $20,000 and hundreds of irrelevant hours of training. Thousands of artists, mostly women-owned small businesses, are being stripped of our wages, entrepreneurship, and rights. A lot of these women are single-income mothers who rely on this career to provide for themselves like me. Last year, I worked on 29 weddings. Out of fear, I have removed my bridal work and pricing from my website and social media accounts. Please support House File 3202 to remove the gross overreach by the BCE.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next person I have on the list is Melanie Rivers. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. For your time and for allowing me to testify in support of House File 3202. My name is Melanie Rivers, and I have been an on-site freelance hair and makeup artist for 8 years and a licensed cosmetologist for 7 years. I provide hair and makeup services for major commercial brands in both TV and print, celebrities, political figures, and for special events, including weddings, galas, proms, and charity events. I wanted to speak on just a few reasons why cosmetology and esthetology school has no real relevance or benefit to our work as freelance artists. My 1,550-hour cosmetology program only contained very minimal education in makeup and upstyling and was a very small fraction of the training that I really use on a daily basis as a freelancer. By the time I'm finished paying off my student loans, I will have paid over $40,000 for an 18-month program. I personally know of at least four freelance artists, including myself, who have been asked to, who attended cosmetology or esthetology school and who have been asked to actually teach the makeup portion of the curriculum. I had already graduated from my program and was told that I wouldn't be compensated because I didn't have an instructor's license. The other three artists that I know of were actually students at the time. So if a cosmetology or esthetology education is necessary to be a successful freelancer, then why are freelancers the ones providing that education? In regards to client safety and proper sanitation, a license does not guarantee a safe work environment. I work in a salon currently with several licensed stylists with manager's license who have zero regard for client safety and proper sanitation practices. The responsibility is up to the individual operator. Most of the freelance artists I know understand that our success in this industry is not just related to our technical abilities, but also our level of professionalism and our standards. Finally, if the BCE was truly concerned with client safety, they would regulate hair and makeup services in every area of the industry, not just special events. They would not exempt artists who work for fashion, film, media, photography, public retail counters as well. They would also regulate services regardless of compensation. According to the BCE, only paid events are subject to regulation. If I choose to do my cousin's wedding for free, I'm in compliance with state laws and rules. So in summary, the inconsistent regulation by the BCE is not in the best interest of clients, artists, or thousands of other beauty industry-related businesses across the state of Minnesota. Please join me in supporting this bill and help protect the jobs of freelance artists across the state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no questions, the next person on my list is Jim Hurst. Welcome back, Mr. Hurst.
Oops, sorry.
Again, state your name for the record.
Thank you. excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, Jim Hurst on behalf of the Salon and Spa Professional Association. Thank you for the opportunity to make comment on House File 3202. I wish to start by thanking the author for making incremental improvements to the bill. However, I wish to say we still remain deeply concerned and troubled by the bill, and I'd like to explain why. First of all, let me start by saying this issue is very similar to an issue that the legislature dealt with, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, and that had to do with eyelash extension services. For those of you who don't recall, what happened was we had a segment of practitioners who were only doing eyelash extensions. They sought deregulation because they thought it was unfair that they had to take 1,550 hours of cosmetology training or 600 hours of esthetology training for just applying their unique craft in providing eye extension services. We agreed. We said, yeah, that is not appropriate to take all that training and education if all you want to do is this segment of the industry. And so what resulted was legislation that created a specialty license specific just for eyelash extensions. Those who were providing that service were grandfathered in. They had to take, I believe, an 8-hour refresher course, pass a state test, and they could get a license just to apply that part of cosmetology. They also then had to take continuing education to renew that license every 3 years. And that continuing education was just 4 hours, not the 8 hours that all other licensees have to abide by. That provides a very good model for what we're looking at today, because the situation is again the same. We have individuals who only want to practice a certain subset of cosmetology or esthetology, and they don't want to take the 1,550 hours or the 600 hours to be able to continue in their operation. It is our contention that we think that the existing eyelash extension law is a good model to be applied in this case as well. And certainly the bill that was originally introduced also called to unregulate eyelash extension services. I'm very glad that that was removed at the last committee hearing with this. And I'm thankful that the author and proponents are recognizing the importance of a at least a modicum of some background training and education specific to health safety and sanitation and infection control issues. However, by the looks of this amendment, it's a one and done. You do it once for 4 hours and you're good to go. You know, in this industry, and certainly Representative Hewitt, you mentioned how much you believe in continuing education, and I think many of you do. That's something that needs to be continuing. It needs to be going on a regular basis, because with these types of practices, there is the application of using tools, brushes. And I commend the previous testifiers saying that they do abide by what is required, disinfecting tools in between clients, washing their hands between clients, and certainly, you know, with the coronavirus issue, you know, we can't underscore enough the importance of proper health and sanitation measures. However, this legislation still needs some work. And let me close by saying that, as was indicated, yes, there is a lawsuit pending on this matter. And unfortunately, one of the parties that should be weighing in on this bill is our State Board of Cosmetology. But because they're party to the lawsuit, it undermines their ability to negotiate and try and find a compromise to addressing this issue. And so, Mr. Chairman and committee members, again, we reiterate our concern about doing complete unregulation of this service. I know that's not the direction that the bill is currently at with the current amendment that's been offered up. But we do have concern that if we just unregulate this, there's no guarantee that other practitioners in the future are going to be abiding by the health, safety, and sanitation requirements that should be necessary and should be incorporated in any type of service. And also, let me also mention, I forgot to state that in regards to the current exemptions and the current special event permit, the state wisely saw many years ago, decades ago, a need for a special permit for homebound individuals who could not come into a licensed salon. The thing about cosmetology is that traditionally it has always been within a brick and mortar establishment. And of course, as time goes on, society is becoming more mobile and everything. So with what the legislature did years ago, they recognized sometimes people couldn't come into a salon, so they created this homebound permit decades ago. In addition, they also created what was mentioned earlier, a special event permit. And again, it's tied to the individual, tied to a salon, and the importance with both a homebound permit as well as a special event permit is that, yes, you have to be a licensed practitioner, but one of the requirements of a licensed practitioner is you have to carry liability insurance so that when you're going off-site, you have that protection. It's also understood that if you are a licensed practitioner, you abide by the necessary health, safety, and sanitation requirements. In regards to the exemptions that are in place, which also go back many, many years, the exemptions, and this was, I believe, 40 years ago, that said, that provided an exemption incidental to movie, television, and theatrical performances. That continues in law. But it should be noticed that when the rules were updated a few years ago, that was clarified more to indicate also fashion and photography. But the rules, and this is where punctuation becomes very important, the exemptions are separated by a semicolon. Within the semicolon for theatrical and movie productions is where you find fashion and photography, etc. So it's within that semicolon of exemptions. And certainly that was caused when movie productions came into the state. But more importantly, I think, and you'll notice this at the end of your evening news or morning news, local news, at the end they'll usually show credits saying hair and makeup provided by XYZ Salon. This is so that the salon could go off-site, do the necessary makeup and hair at the movie, at the television studio for the on-air personalities. But with that, I will conclude my remarks. I thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman and committee members, and I certainly hope that we can find a resolution to this. But certainly it is a little bit tricky given the fact that there is a lawsuit pending with the state board on this matter. And certainly their involvement with a resolution on this is critical, but certainly their hands are somewhat tied because of the pending lawsuit. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Mr. Hirsch, you're and I've got a couple other people questions, but Mr. Hurst, the lawsuit kind of precludes you from being able to negotiate. I mean, because it seems that some of the things they're talking about are reasonable, but with the lawsuit hanging over your head, sort of like the sword of Damocles, what you could say, you may say, or whatever could affect that, and that kind of precludes you from being able to negotiate with the other parties because of the lawsuit. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Mr. Chairman, neither myself nor my client are a party to that lawsuit. So that doesn't preclude me from making comment on this bill or the issue in general. But certainly, as far as enforcement with the existing law and making any changes to that law, it's critical that the State Board of Cosmetology can weigh in. And I suspect they're not really able to, given the fact that there's a pending lawsuit, and it's my understanding, I believe they're in the middle of discovery on this lawsuit, and that's unfortunate because usually, and quite honestly, last spring, our association was approached by a representative of the makeup artist explaining this problem and trying to find a solution. And at that time, we suggested perhaps we take a look at the existing law pertaining to eyelash extensions and create a specialty license, streamline the process so that you only have to take, you know, a small amount of education, pass a state test specific to what you're doing, and move forward. And she thought that was a wonderful solution to it. And at that time, we were well past the committee deadlines, so we couldn't introduce legislation on it. We promised that we would work on this over the interim. However, over the interim, the lawsuit was filed, and I'm mindful in my years of being around the Capitol that when lawsuits are presented in the courts, it's rare that the legislature then dives into the issue until the court has said their piece on it and decided the matter. So we suspended our work as far as creating a solution to this along the lines of modeling something after the eyelash extension law.
And Mr. Hurst, that's been kind of my experience here in the legislature, and I know there's no law, there's no statute or rule that's written that says we don't do that. I've been told it's kind of best practices to, when there's a lawsuit filed between two parties, to not get in the middle of it. It's not similar to contract negotiations that we have, to not pass legislation to get in the middle of contract negotiations, let the two parties get it worked out in court, and then we come forward and do the legislation that might solve the issue. So with that, Representative Huam, you had a question for this person.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hurst, what horrific or tragic event caused the Cosmetology Board to extend their power and domain over weddings?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, first of all, let me state that I do not represent the State Board of Cosmetology. Okay. However, to your point, I believe the state board, I believe they issued a document, something to the effect of making all licensees, non-licensees as well, if possible, aware of the existing law, the existing statute that clarifies who may do these types of special events. And they cited the existence of the existing special event permit, which was put into effect, I believe, back in 2009, so 11 years ago, and warned, basically put out a warning that said, you know, if you are licensed, you have to get a special event permit. They're a regulatory board. It's their duty to, A, enforce the law, and B, make the law be known to individuals out there in this regard. So that's what I suspect the State Board was doing, but again, I don't represent the State Board.
And Representative Quam, my understanding is sometime last year or before, somebody asked, and the state board, that's why the state board came out. I think that was from my conversation last year when this came up, that there was, they were asked, and they put out this, this is what it is. They were asked what the law was. And I've got here in front of me, we did some research. The original law pertaining to this and to regulate the beauty industry was written in 1927, long before you and I were born. Maybe Representative Vogel was alive back then. But, I'm just teasing, though. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do try to respect my elders, so I won't comment on that one. Basically, members and the public listening, a person that repeatedly on this topic comes as an expert list testifier, represents a key component in this type of activity, cannot state a horrific or tragic or any event that caused a governing board to decide that they would expand their domain and their control over another entity. Now, I'm confused because miraculously we're interpreting because of a semicolon that we are now have domain over something. I think that clarification by the legislature is appropriate because apparently some people are confused. Now, it's come through in testimony on multiple committees and times that if you're in a play and all these other activities which are utilizing the same type of skills and as weddings don't require that. And frankly, you know, I've been at one wedding where I participated in with my wife. I know that others maybe have more than one occasion like that. But I've also was asked to perform at the Historic Opera House in Manorville and did multiple performances. And we had a person applying makeup and maybe trying to straighten out my unruly hair. And that apparently, and it's multiple occasions, more people were involved getting their makeup put on in that event than any wedding that I've observed, other than maybe I think some of the royal weddings, there are a few more people. So the concern for the public safety, not predicated by an event or activity that, oh, we got to do something. Why would they do it for a single day event with a very small portion of personnel as opposed to a common event throughout Minnesota where plays are being put on with more people involved, more, you know, events across multiple days and weeks? I think some people are confused, and it's the ones that are deciding that they should expand their domain to, oh, miraculously, the most lucrative portion of this type of activity. And as to the excuse of which I'm glad the chair illuminated to us that the testifier wasn't involved, his client, and he even stated his clients weren't involved, they're just an interested party on the sidelines, as anyone who maybe has a wedding scheduled or would be involved in a wedding. And I think it's very appropriate for us in the legislature to clarify this confusion and also try and write, which I think is a overstep by an agency. And I support the activity that is being brought forth in this bill and really look forward to when we can take it up and pass it along. Thank you.
Representative Doss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Christensen, for bringing the bill forward.
My mother was a beautician. My daughter is a beautician, cosmetologist. That's what they call them now. My aunt and uncle, both were cosmetologists, had a shop down on East Lake Street in Minneapolis. My aunt had a cosmetology and salon in Excelsior. My uncle was a barber. I have a lot of people in the hair business. And I understand the licensing issue. Mr. Hurst, testified a little while ago that we shouldn't unregulate this. Are you suggesting that the way the law is written, that it was always regulated but never enforced? Is that what you were inferring?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hurtos, no, I was not insinuating in any which way that the law was unregulated. The current law, the existing law, specifies very concisely that it is a regulated practice, although there are exemptions, and those exemptions date back many years, and it was in regards to primarily the motion picture, theatrical industry, and certainly the those exemptions, while they were appropriate then, carried through today. It was only when the rules were updated a few years ago, and that was at the desire of all cosmetologists, because the existing rules were put into place. Really, there were always rules, but they were never really codified until the early 1980s. And from 1980 until just a few years ago, there are very few changes, and what changes they were added piecemeal here and there. So there was a desire to just clean up those rules and make them more more efficient for the individual to look at, so there weren't so many cross-references. And it was at that time that the rule pertaining that had said for the exemption, services incidental to theatrical and motion picture type things were excluded. It was at that time that the state board thought it was appropriate to define that practice even further, and that's where they said, you know, and I paraphrase here, but motion pictures, theatrical, fashion, photography, that's it. And then it continued, and I apologize for the confusion over my statement about semicolons, but it was within that part of the exemption that, and the intent is still there.
Representative Hurtos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we've heard from Representative Green about the types of encumbrances that small businesses and small enterprises constantly encounter in Minnesota. We heard Representative Quam ask exactly what is the big event that has occurred that suddenly there's a real big need to do this. I haven't heard any of that. I haven't read about it. I haven't heard that anybody's safety that the public is at risk for this type of activity. Representative Hewat is a paramedic. I was a past registered nurse. You have to be trained and have qualification to start a IV or to draw blood. People expect a certain minimum level of competence with regard to things that truly are going to be invasive upon your body. And years ago, it was determined that the study of cosmetology and the conditions of the scalp and cutting hair and applying chemicals and changing the color, that was something that should be regulated. But here, members, what we see is a perennial problem with the fourth branch of government, the fourth branch of government being the administrative. And so we have good intentions of having rules and regulations and passing laws, but then the administrative takes those rules and starts to expand their interpretation of the law, and it then becomes the force of law just through rulemaking without a lot of oversight. This is troubling, is really troubling. You've heard, many of you members who have been here a while have heard me repeatedly say in committee that in Minnesota, we exceed a third of all trades and occupations require a license to get up and go to work in the morning. This is an increasing problem if we're going to allow people to lift themselves out of poverty and to have opportunities to learn from others a trade or a profession without having to go through the rigors of becoming licensed for things that are truly not intrusive and do not put the public at risk. So Representative Christensen, I'm going to add my name to your bill. Thank you for doing that, and there's just simply no need to create a big encroachment on an industry that certainly has been functioning quite fine by itself. I do recall, and I'll just close with a story. My mother worked with her sister out in Excelsior, and there were many famous people that would come to town as celebrities, and my mother would always be so proud that, you know, she did hair for somebody who was going to be on television here on our local television or whatever, and, you know, she'd get an autographed picture, and that was a big deal. But, you know, back then people would come in if they're getting married, they'd come in and have their hair done the day before, but obviously you got to go to bed, you sleep on things, it needs to be touched up, it's been cut, everything is fine. But we have a new innovation, a new evolution of wedding photography and special events, and, you know, you need the curling iron to put a few curls in and dress it up and make it well. They're not doing anything to these people, and this just isn't a problem that needs to be regulated. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak on this.
Representative Vogel, you had a question, a quick question. We're running short of time. And
Yes, I did, and Mr. Chair, thank you. And not to be repetitive, although somebody my age, sometimes that happens.
My age, too. We're not that far apart.
But, you know, the key thing to me here, and I won't ask the testifier, but the key thing here is lines 216 and 217, where we talk about licensing. And I don't think, unless you've run a small business, you understand the tax that a license causes you. So, you know, I think there's ways to look at the competency of people doing this, maybe the health matters. The real question here from a small business perspective is, do we want to tax these small businesses with the burden of licensure? Because not only are they going to have to follow the CE, which we just made proprietary and could be kind of generalized by franchisors doing their own thing, but now we're going to make them subject to this whole gamut of rules and regulations that they have to know about. And a lot of these are small employers. They might be single practitioners or one or two employees. I just think we have to think about what we're doing to businesses when we make them licensed, because it's not just the CE. It's the whole burden that they're faced with now that they have to be licensed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remembered everything I wanted to say.
Well, thank you, Representative Vogel. And I guess the question I would have for you, Representative Vogel, as a banker, person that had run a bank, would you, as a banker that follows the regulations, would you think it would be fair to compete against somebody who decides across the street to open up a bank or from their home to open up a bank and do banking industry without any regulations, without following the rules that are on the books?
We already do have a credit
Mr. Chair, that's what I was going to suggest.
Well, credit unions are licensed also.
They are, but we have a different tax provisions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
I just want to go on the record because I don't want my emails full today. I am not big on CEUs.
No.
Okay?
We've only got a couple minutes left. Is there anybody that wants to speak on this before we go? We have to be out here at 9:30. So, I saw nobody rushing down. Representative Mason, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if the people at the table can answer the question. What I keep trying to figure out is the differences between the exceptions of putting makeup on in the theaters, et cetera, versus what these people are doing at weddings. It looks like they're doing the same thing, so I don't understand why it's everybody is not under this, or just why this particular group is. What is it that they are doing that is different from the people that are putting makeup on in the television studios, et cetera?
Mr. Hurst.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Mason. I believe the biggest difference is, historically, that exemption has been there, but specific to your point, I think it comes down to the fact that if an individual is applying makeup, here's a good example, at a cosmetic counter, going back to, I think, the 1930s, there was an exemption for that. But at a cosmetic counter, that application is done for free. There is no exchange of money for providing that service of applying makeup. Cosmetic counters, of course, make their money if the individual buys the product. But the individual is not required to buy the product if they go up to a cosmetic counter. With weddings and special events, there obviously is an exchange of money. And so whenever a service is provided that requires money, there has to be an understanding that the person doing that has the training, has the knowledge, is licensed, but also has the liability insurance should anything go wrong. So that's largely the problem. But let me get back to you, because I know I've probably forgotten something, and I know I'm running out of time here for the committee. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Christensen, quickly, we're past our ending
okay.
time.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I do have a few things to say here to wrap it up. First of all, when I was elected out in my district, I was elected because I promised to serve with civility and to be open to ideas from all sides. Also, I want everyone to know that, you know, there's that dirty word regulations, and you know, I'm not a guy, I call them public protections, and I do think they're necessary, but there are times when there is overreach, I believe. And I think this is aimed at women businesses, women clients, and, you know, they are going to be especially hurt by this. So I'd like you to know that we passed out of the GovOps committee unanimously. It's a very bipartisan bill. It's being heard today in the Senate. Karen Housley is carrying it in the Senate, and it has as many DFL authors as it has Republican authors. So I'm proud of that. So I, you know, thank you to support the bill. I think, you know, let's keep working hard at it. It looks like we're going to have to. You know, there's one thing I learned as a freshman here is, even if a bill seems very simple in the beginning, it isn't. It isn't. So thank you so much for your support.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. And with that, members, we're going to hold this over hold this over for possible further consideration, waiting till we get a fiscal note on it that's supposed to be coming. And I want to thank the people that came down here, the professionals that are in the audience, to support the bill and for supporting their families. And members, before we go, Keenan, you want to stand up. Keenan is our permanent page for the rest of the session, so you'll be seeing him, and he'll be the one that'll be handing out the stuff. And members, with that, we're adjourned.